Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by those lovely people at Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It is a great bit of kit, and I love them. And this is an unusual podcast. There's a day I thought I'd get the story of the hot tap and the company behind it. Talking to managing directors and CEOs always seems popular, right? Listeners seem to enjoy the inside workings of businesses and Cooker. Well, I think it's another great story, so that's why I thought I'd do a podcast on it. In fact, their story is often the ones doing them. One of those stories that's doing the rounds on social media is a piece of inspiration. The inventor was tasked with one idea, but came up with another, which we'll find out about in a minute. However, my little warning, I pause there because I always have to give you my little warning. As I always say, these conversations do often come over as an advert for the company, but there's no other way of doing it really when I'm talking to a CEO or a managing director. They're obviously going to promote their wares, and I'm not going to say, what's wrong with your product? I'm interested in the business behind it. So, but I always also say that I think you're smart enough to decide whether you want to spend money on something. So, you know, if you hear the story and go, that's it, I'm going to spend all my money now on hot water taps, then, you know, maybe have another thing. If you can afford one, though, I'd get one. They are absolutely bloody brilliant. I think everyone who listens to this also knows I'm a fan of Cooker. I love mine, and obviously they sponsor the podcast. The history of the sponsorship was I had a Cooker tap. I loved it, so I asked them whether they fancied throwing a few quid at the podcast to pay for production. They said, why not? And since then, we've had a great relationship, one I feel we both benefit from. Now, Cooker was invented in the early 70s, it's a Dutch invention. And I'll tell you what, we might as well get the story of Stephen Johnson, Managing Director, Cooker, UK and Ireland. He'll tell you the whole story as he knows a lot more than me. Here he is. Here's Stephen. Stephen, hello. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Tim. And thank you for having me.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you very much for the sponsorship, which has been wonderful for. I think I was saying in the intro, I think it's been beneficial to both of us, and hopefully you feel the same way.
Yeah, we really enjoy the partnership, and I think you enjoy using the tap. But I think it's a partnership that's evolved across different fronts, so it's really exciting for us.
Yeah, I love the tap. I can't get enough of the tap. Now, listen, before we get on to talking about the tap, because I do love it, let's talk a bit about you. The one thing I do know about you, because I follow you on Instagram, is you're a fitness obsessive. I'm using the word obsessive because I think it's relevant in your case. You are quite obsessed with fitness, aren't you?
Yeah, I am terribly obsessed with it. It is. I start at 5 o'clock in the morning every day, and it's the first thing in my diary. So I really enjoy health, fitness, nutrition. I know you do too as well. And I find it really interesting.
Did you start doing 5 o'clock in the morning? Because I know I've read a lot of those books about the great entrepreneurs and stuff. They like to start an early morning regime. Is that why you do it at that stage, or is that just to try and fit it in your day?
Yeah, really interesting. I didn't also take up health and fitness till I was about my mid-40s. So I got to a point in life where I felt I was out of condition, a bit overweight, and I wanted to get myself into some form of shape. I picked 5 o'clock in the morning, not because it's a time when I'm not going to get disturbed and interrupted, and I find it really sets up the day well. So I'm an early riser anyway. And it suits me to get that out the way in the morning before the phones start, the calls start. So it gives me a good couple of hours where I'm free to focus on myself.
Yeah. Do you have to watch? Are you cautious about, you know, you say you're clearly in your 40s plus. You look very well on it, Stephen. But when you get older, the body is not as good at healing, is it? And I find that if I'm pushing myself too much, I get injuries, which bugs the shit out of me because I want to exercise every day. Are you finding that? Because I'm watching you on Instagram, you don't seem to be holding back at all.
I'm 53, but born in Manchester in 1969. So for me, yeah, I think I could be criticized for overtraining. I've in the 10 or 12 years I've done it, I've suffered hernia, calf strains, broken fingers, dislocated fingers. I've experienced everything. So what I would say is that over the period, I've modified my training. But I think injury is what happens when you train as aggressively as I do.
Yeah, yeah. So when you get injured, though, do you mentally, does it affect you?
Oh, I am. When I talk about overtraining, I think I was in the gym about 3 or 4 months ago using a medicine ball against the wall, and it came back between my fingers and dislocated my little finger. Actually, what the biggest concern for me when I do that is I won't be able to train. It sends me into chaos because actually my training and health now anchors my day. So if I can't do it, it's a huge part missing out of my routine, and it really sets me up.
Yeah, being someone who's had a few issues with mental health, as my podcast listeners know, it's actually putting some discipline into your life is very helpful. So that's why I feel so miserable when I can't train, because I do my training and I do my meditation and I make sure I'm eating the right foods as well and all those things. And the other thing I have a basis, that's like a base for my life, is making sure that I'm secure with my values as well, which I learn. And I think that's really important. If you know who you are and you know you're a good person, that is, it's a lot easier to go through life. And so I suppose every time I get those sort of injuries, discipline is very good for the mind, isn't it, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I like routine, and I would say my routine has evolved over the 10 years I've done it. So I'm now looking at mind and mental health. I do a lot of breath work. I've started to try and do the Wim Hof cold shower and ice bath every morning, which I now do. I started that in July. And what I found is by trying all these different things, hanging upside down, cold baths, jumping out of planes, they really help me deal with stress. I'm not a stressful person, but in my business, I have a really busy day, a lot's going on. And what I found by doing these challenges that they have helped with my stress and that control. So I find it actually quite relaxing when I'm doing these things, which is interesting, and people find that interesting. But to challenge myself in the way I do, it has a real positive impact on my mental health and well-being. And I've never suffered with depression or anxiety, but I do get a lot of stress in work, and I've seen a massive benefit from my change in diet and routine. Me as a person has completely changed.
Yeah, how are you finding the cold showers? I've been doing them for years now, and I find every single time I step in a cold shower, that first 2 or 3 seconds is hell. But then the relief you get from it afterwards is the buzz.
So
phenomenal.
I started in July. There's a place near us up in Pickmere where you go in and do half an hour of Wim Hof breath work, and then after that, you go and submerge yourself in, I think it's 5-degree ice bath. I started that in July when the skies were blue, and I went every week to get into the routine of doing it. Simultaneously, I started the cold showers. I now do it every single day, cold shower. I buy 5 bags of ice when I come home from the gym and put them in my bath. But wow. I'm scared of it. Every single day I get to turn on that shower or get in that bath, I'm having an argument with myself because I don't like it. I absolutely, honestly, if you saw me in my bedroom, I'm standing there thinking, right, it's cold shower and bath time. And I'm looking at it. I actually filmed myself, Tim, to make myself do it. It's that difficult. But the benefit afterwards, if I look at, I'm obsessive with my health stats, but if I look at my sleep score, my stress, it drops by 10, 15%. For 2 or 3 days after, my sleep is incredible. So it's something that I'm going to force myself to keep doing. They do say it gets easier, but I'm yet to see that.
I've been doing it for years, and I don't think it gets easier. But what I think happens is you get more of a buzz and a more of I hate to use this word, but more of an addiction to it, because you know that you enter the shower, it's horrible, or the bath. I mean, I haven't done a bath for such a long time. I used to go to a gym with a plunge pool, which was incredible. But you enter the shower and you do like, I don't know, 5 minutes and it's freezing cold. But when you get out, I don't know if you remember that Ready Breck advert from years ago when they had the red glow around you. Just how you just feel invincible for a while, and you feel amazing, and it's because you know, it's like when you go to the gym, or you're doing you know that day you don't want to go to the gym, but when you finish, you feel amazing because it's you know it's not for the time you're doing it. Even though I get a buzz out of exercise like you do, it's you know when you finish as well, you're going to feel great as well. When you sit and have your first cup of coffee, or when you're sitting and doing, you know, you're doing something, you think, oh, I own the day now because I've done my work, I've done my discipline, I've done that sort of stuff. I absolutely love my cold showers.
One thing I didn't appreciate was how the water gets, obviously I'm stating the obvious now, but it gets colder as we enter into winter. So as I was getting in my shower in July and August, the temperature was fine. Today I get in, it is absolutely freezing. But what for me, the impact it has on controlling your mind is what's astonished me most, because I did the ice work before my parachute jump. I'm scared of heights. And we did a parachute jump for charity in Ireland in September time. And the idea behind the ice was to get control of your mind so that when you go and do a challenge, that you can control your mind. And interestingly enough, when I was in the plane about to jump, I was much more in control of my emotions and mindset. And I didn't find it as scary as I thought I would have done jumping out of a plane. And I think that's because of the work I've done in the ice, absolutely, without any question.
How did you find jumping out of a plane? Was there any moment that you thought, I'm going to die here?
I reconciled it in my head that I did it with a colleague. So I immediately, there was a 50-50 chance it was me or him. I let him go first, which I think made my odds better. But the most nerve-wracking point is when you shuffle to the edge of the plane and you're about to go. However, you're with somebody. So in my mind, all I needed to do was relax, sit on the edge of the plane and relax. That is the most scary moment, and you drop about, I think, 5,000 feet in the first 2 minutes at 140 miles an hour. It's the most invigorating experience ever, but also really apprehensive when you're sitting on the edge of the plane wondering if that chute is going to open. And yeah, really interestingly, before you do a jump, you have to sign your life away, basically. So the first 10 minutes at a parachute school, they're telling you if you hit a car, if you hit the ground, if you hit a plane, if you hit a farmer's field, you cannot claim on anybody. You are, if you do this jump, it is exceptionally dangerous and you are signing all your rights away. So that's the precursor to doing the jump.
Right. I don't think you could claim anyway, because you'd be in a coffin. I imagine, actually, I've spoken to, on this podcast, I've spoken to a couple of special forces guys, and some of them, they've had like a nightmare jumping out of planes and their parachute's not opening, but they're so calm that they cut away the one which hasn't worked. And you think, Jesus Christ, you've got no time. I'd be absolutely panicking. These guys are amazing. Yeah,
it's terrifying.
Have you got into meditation yet? Because I know you didn't for a while, but have you managed to do that yet?
I'm trying my best. I find it really difficult to settle down and meditate. I'm a person that always feels the need to do something, and I've started with it, and it's a project that I need to revisit. It's the only, that and a bit of breath work I struggle with. Right. Finding the time to put aside to do it, because it's probably, I like running around a gym and jumping off buildings. So sitting there breathing or meditating, actually, yeah, I'm thinking, are you being as productive as you possibly can be here? But I really see the importance of it.
Well, I think the Buddhists say meditate for 10 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day. Unless you're too busy, then meditate for an hour. And that always hits me, that one expression, because when I get too overloaded with work, which I was last week, actually, overloaded with work, and I couldn't work out whether I was coming or going. I was trying to plan a holiday and I was trying to do all my work and I was trying to plan stuff for my kids, and I just went, sod it, I'll go and meditate instead. And it just can't, it's a way of settling your mind, and it's a way of watching what you're doing and observing. Observing who you are and who you've become.
That's a skill, though. How did you manage to settle yourself? So you're going through the traumas of that, and that's where I struggle to come away from planning your daughter's holidays, and I struggle to come away from that and be calm and get that out of my mind.
So, yeah, so you don't want to get out of your mind. You want to watch it. So you sit there and just give yourself a short amount of time if you're beginning, like 5-10 minutes. 10 minutes is probably a good time. And then rather than you know the thoughts will keep coming, but you're just watching the thoughts. You observe the thoughts, watch them and go, oh, look, there's me thinking about my daughter, or there's me thinking about my work, or there's me thinking about, you know, what the new tap's going to look like or whatever it is. And you watch it. And as you watch it, then we'll disappear and come, and then you can hear something and that comes into your mind, and it's just observing manages to really calm you and settle you. And it can, what it does is, I think also with me, it makes me prioritize what's important in life. You know, so I'm meditating a lot now, more and more, and the more I do it, the more I love it. But it's about awareness, really. So
do you have a particular time when you meditate then, or
I do every morning, so I do evening as well. I do
you're
gonna laugh at this, right? But this is what I do, right? So I exercise every morning, and then I do a meditation before I start my day, and that's a 20-minute meditation ish type thing. Then I'll try and meditate if I can around lunchtime, but a shorter one. So really just to reset my day and make sure I'm living in the, I have a problem with, I spend the whole of my life, Stephen, living in the future. Yeah. And I don't want to live in the future. I want to live now, but I don't live in the past that much. It's always the future. And then I've got an alarm clock, which goes off at 8:30 every night, which tells me to stretch if I'm at home watching TV, because I'm not supple enough. And I know if I want to stay doing exercise, I've got to stretch. So I've got one which goes off. Then I've got one which goes off at 9:30 every night, which is a recap on the day, which is a very short meditation, which makes me look back at the day and think about all the things that I did well and all the things that I did badly, and always a reminder that I don't need an opinion on absolutely everything.
Interesting.
Even though I do, I have to remind myself, stop having an opinion on everything. You don't need to. You can just watch it. Why do you have to have an opinion?
I think it's challenging, isn't it? What's astonished me with the health, fitness, and nutrition is what's involved in it. I mean, for me, when I started my journey, I thought you just go to the gym and go on a cross trainer, eat a healthy food and you're done. What I suppose the 10-year journey for me, what I've learned and the fact that the gym is different to my nutrition and my nutrition is different to my mindset, but how they all interact with each other, and to get your perfect session with your perfect nutrition and your perfect mindset it's a challenge. And I'm similar to you. I reset myself every day. So I'll have good sessions, bad sessions, but every day I've got enough self-will and motivation to want to do it. But it's exceptionally challenging and difficult to maintain.
Well, you're a lot fitter than me. I've been watching you. God, the stuff you do is absolutely incredible. By the way, have you ever read David Goggins' book? Or are you interested?
Oh,
do you
know, yes.
David? Right. Because what I found interesting about that was the fact when his body seized up, which I could see me doing. That's why I started doing the stretching. I don't know whether you're supple or not, but I'm not. And so it's a real battle
really
for me every day.
I never had time for stretching. I used to look at people in the gym and say, what are you wasting your time doing that for? And yeah, I suffered. I got hernia, calf strains. The point at which my life changed, I had horrendous neck pain into my arm. And I went for cryotherapy, acupuncture. I went to see, I went everywhere to try and get this cured. And nobody said to me once, just go and stretch, mate.
Right.
And I went, imagine what I spent on private healthcare, and nobody fixed it. And then I went to see a friend of mine that used to work at, he actually worked in strange ways in the gym as a PT, and he'd written a book on posture and how to present yourself and how to hold yourself. And quite simply, it was because I was using my phone and had my neck tilted all day. And he taught me the basic principles of stretching. And from that day on, every single day I'll invest half an hour into stretching, and I can now bend over backwards. I'm flexible, and it's alleviated stress as well and tension in my body. So I'm really committed to stretching, and it was a lesson hard learned, but I really enjoy it. Really enjoy it, and it's something even at my age that you can progress with. But what astonishes me how difficult it is that one day I can go in the gym and touch my toes, And then the next day I come in and my hands won't go to my knees.
Exactly right. It's like I do these yoga things and I'm like, and I get to some positions, I think, oh, I've absolutely nailed this. And then she'll say, do this and another pose. And I'll be like, I cannot get anywhere close to, how are these people doing this? What is basically my hips just can't open up enough. But
yeah, so I used to drive around for 20 years and my hips and glutes are horrendous.
Right. Listen, let's talk about Cooker.
You did all right with your ring, though, with your hips.
I did all right. Yeah, hula hoop thing. Yeah, I can do a bit of that. That's not too hard. But before we get on to talking about the actual tap, and let's talk about the company, though, because with this mindset you have, it seems to me that the modern way for a managing director, CEO of company is to try and say, look, the healthier my staff are too, is better for my company and my product. Is that something you're conscious of when looking at your staff?
Absolutely. So I'm really careful. Listen, I'm a vegan health fanatic and I've really bought into this lifestyle, but I'm 53. I've lived a life. I've done all the things that they do. So I'm really cautious in work not to become a preacher, because I think you can get to a stage in life where you're doing it all and you can forget that you were 21 once or 22 and you need to go and have a drink and have fun. But yeah, for me in our business, we employ, I started in 2006, we employ 130 people now of varying age and different health, different fitness, but we invest significantly in their health and well-being, because for me, if a member of staff feels good about themselves, is healthy and well, and don't have any issues, then I believe that there's a chance they're going to perform better in the office than they would do if they didn't have that frame of mind. So as a business, we pay them a wage to do the job, but I take everything around that a lot more seriously. Their health and well-being, their lifestyle at home. I think being an MD or a CEO today is it's a big family, and that's not a cliche. I want these people to be happy and motivated, and I work, and we as a business work exceptionally hard on that. We have psychologists within the business that people can speak to. We will enroll them in gyms. We have lots of schemes going on that will contribute to their health and well-being in lots of different ways. So I see it as hugely important, but it has to be done in a way that doesn't alienate individuals, because there are individuals in my office that are not as fit as others, that don't have as healthy a diet as others. So it's work in progress, and we look to do it by encouragement and motivation.
Yeah, I've done a few podcasts on this sort of thing, and the stats, they show that the healthier and happier that the staff are, the more productive they are. So it just seems ridiculous that people wouldn't care about the health of their staff, because it is.
Yeah,
so
I don't
important.
Think it's common in businesses. We're seen as unique in what we do, to the extent we also fund their lunches and food at work, as long as they're healthy options. So we put a spin on that. So if you come and work at Cooker, we'll buy you your lunch and snacks, providing they're healthy to a degree.
How do you police
and it works.
That? But how do you police it?
Laxly. I've got a gallery out of my office, and I can prod and push if they're buying the wrong type of foods. We encourage. It's not written in stone, but we encourage people to have a healthy diet, a healthy lifestyle, and we see a benefit in the performance when they do operate in that way.
That's a great idea, though, isn't it? We'll give you food as long as it's healthy.
Yeah.
I'm
a vegan. They can have meat and chicken. And what I mean is, I don't really want to see 25-inch pizzas in here with ice creams. You know, they'll maybe get a Nando's chicken and broccoli. So we try and put a healthy spin on it. And it works.
Let's go on to the tap, Stephen. So 2006, you joined the company, or you started, kind of like, it's a bit like a startup, was it really? Because
it was interesting. I was working at a family business, and we sold our business. It was called Neville Johnson, and it still trades today, but we'd sold it. I'd worked in a family business all my life. I wasn't an academic really, didn't love school. And was fortunate enough that my father had a business that I was able to go and work in at the age of 16. So I worked in that business for 30 years. And I tell everybody that was my schooling, my education. I hated school absolutely with a passion. I was not an academic. You know, I didn't take to sitting in classrooms and being taught by teachers. I can learn on the job better. So if you sat next to me and show me how to do something, I'd do it. But in a classroom, I found it a really difficult environment. And thankfully, my father had a really successful business that I basically call my apprenticeship. I got an opportunity to go in that business at 16. I left school as I finished my O-levels, I think, at the time. And I got into that business at the age of 16 and learned absolutely everything over 30 years. We then sold the business. And I'd always had in my mind a doubt as, you know, I'd worked in a family business and was I capable of working for somebody else and making that a success? Family businesses are challenging environments. If you do well, you're expected to do well because you're the boss's son. And if you don't do well, you're there because you're the boss's son anyway. So you can't win in those environments. But what I wanted to, when I sold the business, I wanted to see actually, was I any good? Could I run my own business? Could I take anything I've learned in these 30 years and apply it? And I was at home one Sunday reading the Sunday Times and I saw an advert for Kuka. And Kuka means quick cook in Dutch. It's that's what the name comes from. And they were advertising for somebody to start the business in the UK for them. And I replied to the advert, didn't really know much about the product. They had one in England in a showroom in not far from me that I went to see. And I thought, wow, looks quite interesting, this product. I went to see them in the Netherlands in 2006. The business is owned by, at the time, the inventor, Henri Petri, was still alive, and saw him and his two sons. And after numerous meetings, I agreed to take on the challenge of establishing Kuka in the UK and Ireland. So in Holland, it was invented in 1972. The founder was working at Unilever, and they invented instant soup. And one of his frustrations was, I've got instant soup, but I'm waiting for my kettle to boil. And at that point, he left Unilever in 1972 and embarked on a project of inventing a boiling water tap. It took them 20 years to commercialize it. And I think they went bankrupt about 8 times. And they eventually launched it in the Netherlands in 1992 as a product. And for 10 years, they just traded in the Netherlands. And the UK was that. I think they then went to Denmark in 2004 or 5, and they then came to England in 2006, and I started the UK and Ireland with them in 2006.
Are you aware, you must be aware of this, you probably are the people who are doing it, but are you aware that he does the rounds on the internet as inspiration nor quote, because it's always a thing. I can't remember how exactly it goes. It's like a meme. Instant soup was what they wanted, but I thought, why not make the water tap, da da da, and then it sort of says, you got to think differently or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, is that something that you created, or is that something that just does the rounds, but it's been...
No,
it's
that just does the round. We didn't create it. What astonishes me, the concept is amazing. I know you've got one, I would never ever, whether I worked here or not, I would never be without one. But what astonishes me is how good the product is and how long it took them to get it to market. And get people buying into it. And I look at my journey in the UK. I started in 2006. And I originally started, they wouldn't buy me a car at the time. I think they gave me a hire car and a brochure and said, we'll see how it goes. If you do well, you'll get a car and you'll be here. And I went traveling the country with my brochure, going to see people. And I think half of them had thought I'd lost my marbles. This man sold his company and he's now found this product and he's gone bonkers. And I'm as I say, 16, 17 years in, and people still trying to understand the concept and what it does. It's amazing.
Just picking apart a bit of this, how close is it to, as a business, to, it was custom furniture you were doing with your dad, wasn't it?
Yeah, office and kitchen furniture.
How close is that to going in and trying to flog a brand new invention that no one knows about?
Completely different. One of my frustrations, or one of the challenges in a kitchen business and an office business that we have, is trying to please your customers. So you buy an expensive kitchen, it's got multiple component parts to it, different design schemes. So a customer doesn't always appreciate what they're going to get in a kitchen. So it's sometimes quite challenging to deliver something where they go, wow, it's exactly what I wanted, because it's such a complex area, kitchens, bedrooms, bathrooms, and it's so subjective. And I might explain to you something that looks like this, and you have a vision that it looks like something else. So kitchens, bedrooms, and bathrooms are a really challenging industry to work in, to satisfy customers. What I found with Kuka is it's a product that does, there's no ambiguity with it. You're buying it. It's a tap that delivers boiling water. You can't oversell it. So it absolutely amazing product to sell. It just, I couldn't believe that I'd have people investing in £100,000 kitchens, and all they spoke about was the tap that has a red light when you turn the boiling water. So yeah, just a lot easier to sell the product's USPs and to make the customers happier. But what I would say is everything I learned in my father's business has enabled me to do what I'm doing today. Mm. The education I got in there, being able to work in the factory, in accounts, I got to work in every single department and learn my trade in that business. And everything that I learned there has enabled me to make a success of this business. Yeah. And that's why, yeah, I'm really keen on apprentices and opportunities for young kids, because I've seen for me the privileged life I have, but that apprenticeship I served with my father has enabled me to grow this business to what I have today.
What did your dad say when you said, I'm going to go and sell hot water taps?
Yeah, I think he thought I'd lost my marbles as well.
It's one of those ones, because you're painting it as a really positive experience by buying the tap. Though, my experience of Kuka is I first went around a friend's house, and there they were with this hot water tap. They were rich, and they had this hot water tap, and I was going, holy shit, that's amazing. And I remember looking at it, and then all the things came in my mind, which is what always the pushback is you know, oh, isn't that, you know, kind of really expensive to keep the water hot, and oh, aren't I going to get scolded by it, and also, is it really hot, or is it just like the hot water from my tap? All those things that people push back on was my initial, you know, feelings of it. Then obviously I had a cup of tea and stuff like that from it, absolutely adored it, and eventually get my own one, and I can't live without it. I absolutely love it. But what was it like? You must have had pushback off everybody at the beginning. I've got a kettle, why do I need that?
Yeah, I've got a strong mindset, and I felt what you explained there. When I went to see that tap in the showroom, I could see the benefits of it. I could actually see that, actually, principally, this is a device that's going to save people time. And in the world that we live in, time is an expensive commodity and people are short of it. And I thought, for me, actually, people are going to buy into this because it's going to speed up time. The question is how you promote and sell it. And yeah, listen, in the first year, I remember it fondly. I drove up and down the country. I managed to open 300 kitchen shops to display the tap. So I used to go to a kitchen shop and persuade them to put one on display. I'd persuade the owner to have one at home, and I'd leave one on the shop floor for the next customer. So I always went to an appointment to sell three, one for the owner at home, one for the shop, and one for the next customer, right, and persuaded them to use it. And what I found is when people use this, wow, it was like, they used to phone me and say, thank you, this is the most amazing piece of kit I've got, but principally born out of convenience. It was convenient. But what people, there's a serious, outside of convenience, the product is really sustainable. It saves energy, it saves water. And one thing I never understood is the amount of accidents that are caused by a kettle in a kitchen. So outside of this quirky tap that was giving people true boiling water on demand, I also had a host of benefits with it as well. It's going to save energy, it's going to save water, and it's going to be safe.
Yeah, but that was a message you have to get across, because most of the time people go, wouldn't have one of those taps in my house. I've got children. That's the first thing everybody always says to me. And you think, hold on a second. You know, me and you know that a kettle's more dangerous. But it's tough, because you know, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a push twist system. I mean, some adults in my life can't do it.
it's funny you say that. That's how we challenge people. So people that would say to us, it's not safe and for kids, we stand them by the tap and say, okay, turn it on. And what you see is them standing there, they can't turn it on. But it's a huge barrier to market that for us, Tim. We still today, 16 years, 17 years into this journey, we still have people that are, it can't be safe, it's dangerous. And it's our job to educate people that actually it isn't. And the way in which you use it is actually impossible to turn it on by accident and have your hand under it because of the way it operates. But it's a case of us educating people, and tirelessly over the 17 years, that's what I do. I educate people on it's safer than a kettle. Our sales story and how we promote the product has remained exactly the same over 17 years. Exactly the same. And you're picking on huge barriers to market because of safety, could be dangerous. And those are issues we have to face.
Yeah, it's a tough sell, isn't it? Selling in something that people think they don't need because they've got a kettle, they've got a hot water tap, and they've got oven hobs which they can boil their water for their veg, and they've got a kettle for their cup of teas and their cup of coffees and things. They don't really need this. That's where it's a very interesting product, because when you get it, you go, how the hell did I survive without this before? But until you get it, you think there's no point. It's a tough sell for you, isn't it?
Yeah. So the cost of living crisis has helped us. I'll come back onto that, because people are suddenly faced with understanding the cost of energy and water. So one of the challenges for us has been, getting people to understand that actually as a product that you might not think you need it, but when you get it, it becomes your most used appliance in the kitchen. So through our education, what we try and say to people is how you think of a dishwasher and a fridge and what you spend on a fridge. You see some of these fridges that are £15,000-£20,000 that you will open three times a day. When a cooker tap's installed in your kitchen, most people think it's just tea and coffee. Actually, in my house, I use it for everything. I don't use a dishwasher, I use it to wash plates. I use it to clean my drinking flasks. I use it to blanch vegetables. I was at an event the other week and a chef, Olivia Burt it was, cooked a whole meal with the cooker, right, with nothing else.
Yeah.
So the what we try and get people to understand is, not only is it convenient, not only is it safe, not only does it save you energy and water, but it becomes your most used appliance in the kitchen.
Yeah, you do use
more
it.
Than anything.
You end up using it for cleaning, especially when you've got stuff which is ground on the dish, on the saucers or whatever. You think, I'll put some boiling water on this. This will get it off.
Yeah.
And it does. I suppose one of the things, though, you mentioned it earlier, is the time-saving element. And you'd think people in their own kitchen wouldn't care about that. But I did a podcast with Oliver Burke, Burtman, sorry. It's called 4,000 Weeks. And there's some amazing stat that at workplaces, there's so many microwaves which still have 3 seconds left on the clock because people can't wait the whole 3 minutes to cook their microwave meal or whatever. They have to get it out. Wow. And apparently the actual number is 3 seconds, I think he said. It's like people cannot wait another 3 seconds. So I think, you know, I agree with you that people think the idea of having something which saves time, I don't have to wait for a kettle to boil, is probably very attractive to them.
Yeah, we see that when a tap breaks. So we have 80 engineers running around the country. And what you see is if somebody's tap breaks, they're so reliant on it for convenience that I call ourselves the fourth emergency service. We have to be there pretty quickly to fix it because they're used to having on-demand boiling water. So it becomes a part of life. So I see it when the taps break or they don't work or we need to repair them, that you see the stress coming from the client because they're deprived of the opportunity of instant boiling water.
Mm. Why did Cooker decide to give the task for you to break Britain and Ireland?
I think at the time Cook was a small business, just had 40 people working in it. So it was a small business. I think the fact that I had previously worked in the kitchen industry and understood the nature of that business in the UK, but also that I'd sold directly to consumers on a direct basis without a showroom. So Kuka will supply the tap with a new kitchen, but if you don't have a kitchen and you just want a tap at home, we offer a service where we will supply a tap for you at home and come and fit it with one of our engineers. And I think my experience in working B2B and B2C gave me an edge over the other people. In hindsight and retrospect, it's a marriage that's worked exceptionally well for all of us. Really enjoyed it.
Excuse my ignorance, what does B2B and B2C mean?
Business to business and business to consumer, sorry.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Just wanted to make sure that I knew what that was. Had no idea. So that's good. Obviously, along the way, along your adventure since 2006, people have seen that there's a demand for this product and you've now got competition, haven't you? Have many more companies entered the market, and is that a problem for you?
Yeah, so we now have, there's about 65 different companies in the UK that make products. What we have at Kuka is a patent on a certain part of the product that gives us an advantage. And we are the only tap in the world that delivers at a true 100 degrees. So we have a USP that for me is undefeatable, but my competitors are very successful companies. They make great products, but the way that we reconcile with our customers is prior to them being hot or boiling taps, if you went into John Lewis to buy a kettle or an oven, they wouldn't sell you one that, you know, a kettle, here's one, Tim, that does 100 degrees. But if you want to save a bit of money, Tim, round the corner, I've got another kettle that doesn't quite do the job. It heats to about 80 degrees, but it's less. Yeah. So what we have in our industry is, yeah, significant competition now, but doing a different thing because they can't do what we do. So we have to educate the market now that not only is there multiple taps, when you're looking for your tap, be sure you get one that truly boils, because there are products in the market that can't achieve the temperature. So it's added a complexity into my business, but it's also helping us grow the market.
Is that what took them so long to get it to market, to keep the water boiling hot for that length of time? I mean, I talk about it on my podcast when I'm doing the promo bit at the top, and I always say it's a vacuum. Literally no idea what that means, but for some reason there's a vacuum used to actually keep the water at that temperature. Or was that the thing that was invented right at the beginning?
Yeah, it's the vacuum invention. So we store water under pressure at 110 degrees in a vacuum. Not when you say it like that, you think, bloody hell, why did it take them so long to do that? Because actually, it's not a complex piece of kit. It's quite a simple piece of kit, right? But it's the invention of the vacuum. And then the challenge is making it watertight, robust. You look at your water where you live, it's horrendous. So you've got the challenges of the devices getting wrecked by poor quality water. So you've got to invest in the quality of the product as well. And that's what they've done well at Kuka. So they've got the patent on the vacuum, which is, for me, a significant advantage, really significant. And it ensures that our product, I feel, performs a bit better and offers a little bit more than others. But yeah, it's not a complex piece of kit, but it's an amazing invention.
So you've got 40 people when you first started working at Kuka. How many have you got now? Or how many are you? How many are there? Because, I mean, the developments of them, even since I've had one, you've introduced all sorts of different things, including sparkling water. So clearly there must be a development team there. How many people are working?
Yeah, so Kuka, I remember it fondly because when I first started with them, I wasn't allowed to fly there and back. I had to drive the Kukas in my Audi from Holland to Manchester. So I know that I had an Audi A4 BL07 XNA, and I could fit 36 Kukas in that car. And I used to go to Holland in 2006 and drive them back to England. And when I've sold them, I used to go back with the Falters and do the trip again. And there were 40 people. There are now 650 people worldwide It's a business that turns over in excess of 250 million euros internationally and throughout the world. But it's a business that stayed true to its roots. It's still a family business that cares about its employees. It's an amazing business, one that invests in its employees, the product. I'm so lucky to have found them and at the beginning of an amazing journey. And it's a business of huge scale now.
But how long was it before, right, 2006 you started, how long was it before you started thinking this is actually going to work? Because there must have been a few years where you're thinking,
I live in fear of failure, which I think we talked about at the beginning. Not once have I sit here today, you know, this year we will be close on £100 million business. And I never, you mentioned you never look back. I never look back. That to me is done, dusted, history. What I look at is the future. And what I see with this product is amazing potential. Amazing potential. And for me, it's about us giving a really good service, having a happy and healthy workforce. And I think if we can continue to achieve that, the opportunities are significant. I always say to people, if the tap was free, I don't think there would be anybody that wouldn't keep one. I think the only barrier to people having these is the price. But I think if you gifted everybody a Kooka tap and said, you can have it, if you value it, you can keep it. And if you don't, we'll take it back. I honestly think there's very few people that would give it back. So that gives me a huge confidence for the future that the potential with this product is insane.
Has Brexit affected you at all?
Yeah, horrendous. But the interesting thing with Brexit was it affected me the moment we decided to leave the EU because the currency collapsed. So when people say to me, how's Brexit affected you? Did it hurt you most when we left the EU in 2021, was it? I said, no, actually, the biggest problem it gave was that the exchange rate collapsed to parity overnight. So the cost of me importing the product became far more expensive. And what I've had for the 2 or 3 years leading up to us actually coming out of Brexit was horrendous pressure on prices and margin because the exchange rate had gone against us. Brexit then happened. The exchange rate became better. But what we then ended up with is a scenario where we can't deliver stuff to Ireland from the UK. So I then had to open offices in Ireland and separate the Irish entity from the UK. So we ended up with a Kooka Ireland and a Kooka UK. So it gave me challenges and it gave us problems. But I say to everybody, I can't think of a time when we don't ever have challenges or problems because had the financial crisis, Brexit, we come out of Brexit, we get COVID, we come out of COVID and we got the cost of living crisis. So actually for me, in my whole business life, there's always a crisis. And what's really funny at Kooka, these crises always seem to bring us positives. So with COVID, in the darkest moments of COVID, our business evaporated to nothing overnight. And then all of a sudden, everybody was at home and we had a boom in people investing in the house. So we went from 12 weeks of me thinking, oh my God, we've got no business, to actually, how are we going to cope with the demand? And for the preceding 2 years, our business doubled. We then come into the cost of living crisis. And again, there's been help for the brand because people are talking about sustainability. For the first time ever, I've got customers asking me about the true cost of energy and water with an interest. And previously, it's been really difficult to engage consumers in sustainability and what it means in purchases and why investing in a Kooka is important because you save water. And most people think water's free, I think, because it comes out your tap. People don't understand that water is a finite commodity that actually is potentially going to run out in the future. And we're probably going to have wars with nations fighting over drinkable water. So it's sustainable. It's incredible.
What about the energy then? Tell us about it.
So in terms of what's interesting with a tap, and you save energy on a Kooka because actually you're storing water under pressure at 110 degrees. So you're not expending any energy to sit it there. Whereas with a kettle, it's 1600 watts to boil it. So I think on average, a kettle is about 3 to 6p a boil, depending on where you are. And a cooker will be about a penny equivalent. So in terms of energy and money, there is a financial saving of having a cooker. But it's your energy on a kettle might be £150 a year. Your energy on a cooker might be £50 a year. So the there is an energy saving, but the most comprehensive saving is in water. Because people overfill. They always fill the kettle to 1.7 litres and boil all of it and then only drink one cup. They then reboil water and drink it, and it's really bad to reboil water. And if they it's got some health benefits. If you reboil your kettle water, it takes out minerals in the water. It makes it unhealthy to drink. If you do any independent research on that, you shouldn't reboil your kettle water. So consequently, if you don't do that, you throw 1.7 litres down the sink.
I love the accuracy of 1.7.
1.7. So that's the boiling side. And then you look at the chilled and sparkling, which was a later addition for us. And I very quickly talk about a litre plastic bottle of water. So a litre plastic bottle of drinking water has 3 litres of water wasted in the manufacturing process. So a 1 litre bottle has 4 litres. To make it. So when you deliver your sparkling water from a cooker, you get what you need when you need it, and you're not wasting the plastic.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. You look at the bottled water market. What do bottled water companies make? They make plastic bottles. They actually put in those bottles the water that you and me drink from general water.
Yeah.
It's bonkers.
Yeah, your passion for this is phenomenal.
Ridiculous. Sorry. Yes. Yeah.
No, it's great. It's fantastic. And it must have been quite hard for you during the pandemic as well, because obviously, with anything, if you buy anything, there's a chance it can go wrong. And if there's there must have been a time where your engineers weren't allowed to go around to people's houses, and there was probably forts with them, and there's no way you can come into that. I imagine there was a time where you just weren't getting access to the customer at all.
Yeah, we had 12 weeks where we could do nothing. March the 24th to June the 14th, 2020. Those dates are ingrained in my head. I remember Boris standing in my living room telling me I had to shut my business. Those 12 weeks were horrendous, and we couldn't service our customers, and we couldn't, we didn't know what we were going to do. But come the end of that June the 14th, 2020, you can light a switch or turn a switch on. And the business, it was so bizarre. It went from running at an amazing level to zero, to nothing. So it stopped. And I'm sitting in my building with everybody at home thinking, wow. And then on June the 14th, it's like you turn a switch on and it doubled and doubled again. Just insane.
So as a business owner, do you have to be careful not to overstaff and overstock, because you don't know whether this is going to carry on? Is it? Do you have to tread with a bit of caution?
Yeah, really. I'm very, very cautious in the way I operate. My father taught me at a very early age that cash is king. You always need money around you. Don't make decisions that leave you short of money. Be able to make your own decisions. So in terms of business, we operate within our means, which is really important to me, that every decision we make is one that we can financially afford. We're fortunate enough to build the business on our own reserves, so we don't borrow money. But it's really challenging. Yes, I think it's a challenging world we live in. And if you look at COVID, cost of living, it's not too difficult to make a bad decision. So it comes with challenges. But I think ultimately we take the view at KUKA that this is about a lifetime. We don't make quick decisions for this week, this month. We look at the long term. And actually, what I know we have is an amazing product. And if we can give And a really good service with that and keep our customers happy and be trusted as a supplier, I think we'll continue to grow.
How many houses are you in now? Do you know the how many houses?
Yeah, we've got 400,000 systems installed across the UK and Ireland.
Wow.
And so there's 400,000. And I know that because we have, in certain areas of countries where the water's bad, we have to service and maintain them. So we have 80 engineers in the field running around servicing products. We do over 2,000 visits a week to maintain and service these products. And what's really challenging in his business is make sure that every single one of those interactions is to a customer satisfaction. So when I started the business in 2006, it was me. If I'm dealing with you, Tim, I'm going to make you happy. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to give you a service. If you're not happy, you're going to phone me. I've now got a business where I don't know all my staff by name. I don't know all my customers by name. But what I want is every single customer to have the most amazing experience. And that is challenging.
So when I walked in and I saw it in my friend's house, I was like, wow, I want one of those. That was how it really was marketed to me. But that was years before I actually got one. I was like, oh, one day I'll have one of those. Now, how do you go about marketing them? Obviously, the best form of marketing and advertising you can have is someone walking into my house, me doing it, and them going, I love that. Obviously, there's 400,000, so there isn't enough for everybody to walk into somebody's house and see one. So where are you finding that you have success from doing this? I see you do a lot of advertising on social media, good advertising there. Is that where you go, or are you going to magazines? How are you finding it? TV?
Yeah, so we will promote the product across a variety of different platforms, television. So we TV advertising, we use social platforms, so Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and we use direct marketing, so from databases that we have, and we use press, so we use the Sunday Times, the Daily Telegraph, so we go across TV, digital, and press, and we're looking to raise people's awareness of the product. And what we then do from that is offer a virtual selling platform, so you can come and view the product from your living room in our showroom, see it working, touch it, engage with the brand from a distance, and that's how we promote it.
Yeah, what's the dream for you then? How many houses do you want to be in?
No, I don't. For me, the dream, a funny dream I have, Tim. It's not about for me, it's about the company values and the challenge I'm faced with now. And I use challenge, maybe not the right word, but I've gone from me on my own in 2006 to 130 people, a significant business. I want to run the business in the way that I do it. So I'm not a corporate. I don't like corporate environments. So the way that we run KUKA is we run it as a family business. Everybody's really important. So the challenge for me is seeing if I'm able to keep doing that as we grow, because you get more and more people in. You might not get somebody that's as trustworthy as somebody else. It's, for instance, like with the lunches, we don't put a budget on the staff ordering lunches. We rely on them to be commercial and not cheat us as a business. So if you were working for me, Tim, you come and get your lunch, but I'm not going to say to you, you can only spend £5 or £15 or £25. We want you to buy the lunch you want, but within our business, understand that it's a privilege.
Wow.
and don't abuse that privilege.
Wow.
And what's really interesting, we had it, and I never used to check the delivery bills. And then somebody said to me the other day, you need to check them because you've got someone in your business that's perhaps not using it in the way that you thought they were using it. And I went to look at it, and yeah, somebody was ordering some drinks at home in the evening. and yeah, so the member that raises, he said, what are you going to do? And I said, do you know what? I feel let down. But that's the risk that I run of running the business in the way that I do. And I desperately don't want to enforce rules and regulations on people. So we're trying to develop the business where people understand how you have to behave and what you have to do. And that for me is the biggest challenge I face, whether I'll be successful in achieving that or whether it's not possible to get something to the scale we have and run it in that way. So that's one of my challenges for future. The other is quite simply, I look at sport and I look at teams like United, who I'm a City supporter. And in my youth, United dominated that division year after year, after 21 years. I think at my old business, I think I even had to do a corporate at the 1999 Champions League, United Barcelona, because City, I just couldn't take any of my customers to City because they never had any decent games. But I use that a lot in my business because I look at United, who were hugely successful over 20 years. And for me, they took their eye off the ball. They didn't look at the future. They became confident in their abilities. They were number one. And I look at them now and I think they're not as good as a number of other teams in the division. They're underinvested. And for my business, we've had 16 years of every single year we've done better than the last. So that one of my proud records is every week we've been in business, we've always done better than the week before. We've always improved. And my fear is one of not improving next year. So right. I live in fear of failure. And therefore, for me, you've got to constantly reinvest in yourself, reinvent yourself, look at how you're going to develop business and not stand still. So I'm totally driven for the future, but I live in fear of not achieving what I believe will be the ultimate for this business. I think it can be a hugely successful business.
You know, what's interesting is I've got friends in Norway and I go and visit him. He's a very successful businessman. And I've got another friend who used to be in Russia, no longer, but I went to visit them. Both of them, on both occasions, when I went into their companies, got to lunchtime, they said, do you want some lunch? And they would put on lunch for the staff. I wonder why in Britain it is that we decided we weren't going to feed people at work. So I imagine at one stage there probably was a situation, but in Norway and Russia, and when I told them about this, they were going, what, they don't feed people? And why do they come to work? And it's like, but they were just, it was just basic food, basic healthy food, but they put on a hot dinner for them every lunch. It was part and parcel. And you can see now Google are doing it, you're doing it through the way you're doing it. And it seems strange that we got to a culture where we wouldn't look after the staff, don't you
think?
Yeah,
a really strange culture. And actually, times changed how staff are treated. I think when I worked in my family business, it was a completely different environment. And I think businesses run on, I think you ran your staff on fear of failure and you manage them in that way that they had to perform. I think business has changed. But I have a lot of my friends that question, my father comes in as well and says, you've got to be mad buying them all lunches. He can't understand it. And I simply say one thing. I'm in the centre of Manchester with 60 people in an office. Every day, those 60 people could vacate my building for an hour and go around town. So I could lose 60 hours a day of productivity because they just go out for what they're entitled to is their lunch break. If what happens in my office is at 11 o'clock, all the menus get opened and everybody has a big discussion on what they're having for lunch. And at lunchtime between 12 and 2 in my office, nobody leaves this building. They all sit at their desk, eating their lunch, chatting to each other, but I also get a bit of work done. So for me, the reward of giving them lunch gives me a huge business benefit.
Also, I suppose they're communicating with each other over lunch, which is what, speaking to a few people on this podcast, trying to get the staff to communicate with each other is always a good thing because it always helps businesses. Stephen, we come to the end of the hour, but just whilst I've got you here, for anyone who's starting businesses, what advice would you have for them? Any pearls of wisdom?
I think find something that excites you and motivates you that you have a genuine interest in, because I think starting any business is exceptionally difficult and challenging. So have something that you enjoy, believe in, and be frugal with how you spend your money and invest in it. I think for me, lots of businesses fail. They have great ideas, but they ultimately end up running out of money. They overspend at the beginning. So for me, something that you enjoy and have enough money to see that project through.
Great advice. Thank you so much for joining me, Stephen. And as I said in my intro, it does feel like an advert, but it's a great product. If you can afford one, I'd have a look at it. Go to kuker.co.uk, kuoker.co.uk. And if you want to email me at all, lovejoyhour@gmail.com if you've got any questions or comments on anything I do. Thank you so much for joining me, Stephen, today. Thanks a lot.
Lovely. Thank you.